Okay, so can I just thank all the speakers? So before we have questions, could I just ask, could all, whoever's a surgeon in the audience, could they just put their hand up, please? Okay, and how many oncologists? Okay, so I think there's a lot more surgeons here. So I think this is a really good opportunity because I don't know what it's like in your MDT, but I'm going to give you an example of what happens to someone who's 80 quite often in our MDT. Now, obviously, I work in Glasgow, so patients aren't always the fittest. But the conversation will go like this. So we'll have an 80-year-old, say, for example, who's had breast cancer surgery for a grade 3, 4-node positive, triple-negative breast cancer. And we put up on the sheet, the first thing that comes up is chemotherapy. And the oncologist will go, So then I say, but they're very fit. And then I'll say, they cycled to the clinic. They cycled down the Great Western Road. That's like, you know, Charing Cross Road in London. And then I'll say, they climbed up 3 Munros at the weekend. So Munros are kind of tall mountains. They climbed up 3 Munros and carried down an injured walker on their back. And it's still kind of, And I'll say, but you know, they're really fit. And quite often they say to me, well, they won't be fit by the time I finished with them. And although that's funny, that is kind of, I think, sometimes what we face at the MDT. And I find that really difficult to then know what to say to patients kind of about that. So I think it clearly, I think as surgeons, we have kind of upped our game a little bit. We're going to hear about it later in how we assess patients as fitness, fit for surgery. And we have a target and the number of patients who we should be operating on. And I think most times we achieve those targets. So I'd like you all to think of the questions because this is a golden opportunity. We've got a huge expertise of oncology and statistics here. So we can think of all those questions that drive you absolutely mad, as they sometimes do me at the MDT. But just before you have your questions, on the panel with us today, we've got Mrs. Maggie Wilcox, who is with the Independent Cancer Patients Voice, and she just wants to say something about some leaflets she has, which I think would be very helpful for people.
Yes, I just wanted to draw your attention to the APPG report. And Delith has promised that if we take names down at our stand, she will supply people if they want a copy. And it's really well worth looking at. But we've also got other information on the stand that could be useful to you to explain how we fit in. I'd like to make a plea for proper information for patients that's easy to understand. We're not all Olympians like Dorothy. And it needs to be the person, not the condition. It's the whole person that you need to look at and talk to and listen to and some sort of shared decision-making coming into it. And that's not easy. And maybe when we're talking about education and communication, Leslie Fallowfield's done a brilliant job, but I think we could also include patients in that education. And if we had live patients to healthcare professionals, in sharing that teaching, it would be helpful. The healthcare, I've been one, and you can be very protective of patients. And no, you can't possibly offer them that trial. They're all stressed out. So you can't do it. But you should, because if you don't offer them the choice, then you're denying patient choice. And we're not made of glass. We can say no.
And I'm not aware of it, but is there any specific information for older patients receiving adjuvant therapies? Because clearly the kind of toxicities are potentially different. I know we don't have any. Alistair, is there any information out there?
So without wishing to plug the Bridging the Age Gap study once again, that's exactly what one of the initiatives has been, with the help of the Cardiff unit and Sheffield unit, to design information for patients in a language that's we hope is accessible to them. It's designed with patients, and what it goes about is designing an option grid for the patient based on their cancer, what their wishes are, what their aims are, to try and inform that decision. As you say, it's not widely available because it's part of a study at the moment, but the hope is obviously that sort of initiative rolls out in due course.
Okay, so we're opening questions up to the floor. So anyone, any questions for the panel? So could you just please, because it's quite hard to see with the lights, just say who you are, what profession you are, where you come from.
Surgeon and guys. Just a comment about the oncologist response to this very fit 8-year-old. My concern would be, I mean, I don't really believe that the majority of us at the moment are ageist, and we are very keen to treat the patients to the best we can. But if the response is because genuinely they believe that there will be more harm than good, then we have really to stop and think about it. And what I hope from a day like this is that we educate the MDT to what in actual fact, what is safe practice, and what we can provide to our patients in the best possible way without compromising their life.
Okay, so can we just have some comments? So clearly, Dr. Moss has performed a big study where you did manage to get lots of older patients in this clinical trial. And, you know, how do you think we... Because I think there is sometimes a perception that we are going to do harm by giving adjuvant treatments. How would you kind of address that?
Right. Well, I think the first thing when we see a patient, we're very fixed on age. But it's really not the age of the patient when you see them. It's their life expectancy. And it's it's very heterogeneous in older patients. So in the United States, and I'll bet it's true in the UK, a woman in average health who's 75 will live an average of 12 years. But within that, there's vast differences. And so what I think is very helpful, and it's available to everybody here, is using models on the web, like e-prognosis. And I don't know if anybody's used it, but these are models based on huge studies of community-dwelling elders, people in hospitals, that you can put in. And they ask questions like, can you dress yourself? Can you walk a half a mile? And you can get a lot more granular data. So I think the first thing you got to know about your patient is not really their age, it's their life expectancy. And then based on that, what is their potential benefit from chemotherapy? And I think for people with triple negative breast cancer who are old with great life expectancies, like the one you talked about, those patients, if they recur, they will recur in the first 5 years and die of their cancer. So I think you've got to inform the patient. I use actually Predict UK, which is a great model developed here, to look at the numbers. And I think in the UK you use things like 3% benefit to discuss it and 5% to recommend it. I don't think they're perfect numbers, but I think they're very good guidelines. And I usually go over that with the patient. And then I take the common regimens and use what we know about the toxicities. And they are important. And the patient's lives will be affected during the chemotherapy. But if that person says, and we heard Clark today accept chemotherapy in her 80s, very aggressive anti-HER2 therapy, I want to do it, it's worth it to me, I do it. And if the patient says, you know, I don't think it's worth it to me, even with these potential benefits and potential side effects, I wouldn't do it. But I think there's a lot of information we can give patients. What we don't have is things like Alistair's talking about, is big databases to know on some of the newer regimens. What exactly are you left with as far as your neuropathy from taxanes or your 10-year risk out for cardiac disease? But you've got great data from the Early Breast Cancer Trials Collaborative Group and things on competing causes of non-breast cancer mortality, and they're probably not going to be dramatically high. But the quality of life affecting symptoms like neuropathy, perhaps cognitive function, you know, are very important. But that's kind of the strategy I use. So I would, depending on that patient, I would be convinced if they're carrying people up the hill that it's worth talking about chemotherapy.
Okay, any Okay, a question here. Can I just ask you one thing? When we talk about quality of life, for patients who are sometimes older, things like living independently, not having care, people coming in, and when I've tried to quantify that to a patient, there doesn't seem to be any data out there. So if I do an axillary dissection, I can say, so you've got this chance of getting this, this chance of getting that. What percentage of people who receive adjuvant chemo, for example, go from living independently to kind of, because that's quite important to people.
That's a great question, and I think that's why we need the study you're doing here in the UK to collect these data prospectively. The study we're doing in the U.S. is led by Arthi Haria, and what we've done is all women 65 and older who go on to chemotherapy get a geriatric assessment. We're looking at molecular markers of aging that might predict toxicity as well as function, and we're collecting your functional status along the way. We've got about 350 patients out of 500. So to know how many had to go from their home to assisted living, we're collecting all these outcomes. The data we have are all small studies, like things you see on docetaxel cyclophosphamide, very common regimen TC in the United States. You have to look at small studies like small French studies, 100 patients. Those patients look like they did well, but you don't know how they were selected. Very small sample sizes. So your questions are great ones, and I don't think we have those accurate data. But also, as you're treating the patient, you can bail out. You don't get treated, get immediate toxicity, and that's it. Hair loss is a little different, but you can bail out. So if you're getting into neuropathy or other problems or hospitalization, you can bail out.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there is reasonable evidence that a comprehensive geriatric assessment at the time of initial consultation does change management. And I think in many of our multidisciplinary teams, we clearly don't have that input. And the amount of data that we're making, sometimes these quite fine judgments, particularly in patients who have degrees of maybe of cognitive function, which are quite difficult to assess. And yet we don't have the input from the specialists in geriatric oncology and in geriatrics who have the skill sets to help make those kind of judgments. And as Matti Apro was showing this morning, there is significant variation across Europe in the use of specialist geriatric input into centres, and it's particularly patchy in the UK. And I think the challenge for the UK, I think, as you're showing, it's sort of tripling in the numbers of patients in that elderly age group, is that we need to bring in formally into the MDT those with skills in geriatrics to help make those quite difficult decisions which have a significant impact on patients' lives.
Alistair?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I mean, two things about CGA. I don't know if Margot's here yet, but essentially it's about making sure that when you do the CGA, it's validated for the question you're addressing. So, you know, is it a validated tool for... Because effectively you're talking about sometimes withholding treatment on the base of that test, so are we comfortable that it's robust enough to do that? And secondly, the really important point you make is it's about if you identify problems in the CGA, not just saying, oh, you're not fit enough for chemo, you're not fit enough for radiotherapy surgery, whatever it is, but doing something about it and intervening. And to intervene, we need the expertise of care of the elderly specialists. And the hope is, obviously, you can intervene, make patients better, and this has been shown in the metastatic setting to be feasible, so the patient can go on with their radical treatment with safety, hopefully.
There was a problem at one stage with referring to the other speciality, wasn't there? It had to be a new referral.
I think sometimes that is an issue, but as much as anything, it is simply having the capacity and for access to geriatricians or geriatric nurse specialists, whoever, and all the other specialists, not just them, it's the physios, the OTs, yeah, the dietitians, whoever else who needs to be involved to improve the whole package of care.
Okay, we've got a question here.
Just a comment. It's an old-fashioned thing, but actually all of the doctors in this room at the age of 24 knew what a stethoscope and an ophthalmoscope was for. And we've got the situation now in which there's now becoming a committee decision as a consultant surgeon seeing a patient in a clinic with their family. At that point in time, the patient's pretty fit. by the time they get to an MDT and they've had an operation, their activity status is going to be down. But surely it is the surgeon who sees the patient in the first instance who has the responsibility for making the primary decision about go, no-go in forms of treatment. You may need help with interpreting an ECG if you've forgotten how to do it at a later stage, but actually committee decisions on these sort of patients lead to all sorts of disasters.
Would anyone like to comment on that?
I would entirely agree with that. I mean, I think we regard the MDT as guidance to the clinician who is making the decision, but there are often factors which are of which the MDT may not be aware in terms of, you know, the comorbidities of the patient that the surgeon or the oncologist may pick up. So I think I always regard the MDT as guidance, but it's ultimately the surgeon or the oncologist who's discussing it with the individual patient who has to take a view. And indeed, if they take a different view from the MDT, we often bring that back to the MDT to say, well, in light of what I've seen, I think this would be inappropriate and we may rediscuss it.
Nathan Coombs in Swindon. I wonder if the panel's got a view on the rural population. A lot of our patients travel 1,500 miles to receive radiotherapy. They'll make their decisions based on the practical aspects. Do they have family members that can drive them? They don't want to travel that distance. What about giving treatments all in one go? And also, you make decisions based on, as you say, the patient and the family in front of you rather than just on a series of numbers.
So we obviously in Scotland have a rural community, and we looked with Adrian Harnett at people who lived and had to travel, often three boats, a long ride, and their acceptance of adjuvant treatment was actually greater than the people who were in Glasgow. So for us, distance didn't seem to affect, and we presented that. Anyone else want to comment on that?
Yeah, I like what Maggie Wilcox just said about shared decision making. So in a sense, practicalities of treatments are very important, and patients often have views on what they're happy to accept. The other thing to say in this is I hope fast forward will change this. So at the moment, we have 3 or 4 weeks of radiotherapy coming every day, Monday to Friday, and that's quite a big undertaking. It's possible that in the future we may be able to just deliver 5 fractions of radiotherapy, which will be more practical for patients. Have you got anything to add to that, Ian?
Well, certainly within the PRIME quality of life trial, the research nurse asked the patients if they had any other particular concerns. Those were not randomized data. But one of the recurring themes that came out was concern about travel and parking. And these things are these are very relevant, particularly to older patients. I mean, we do have residential accommodation for patients in our centre who are travelling, and many centres have that. But it is a factor that often weighs with them.
We've got a question right at the back.
Could I just qualify a little bit? I think patients sometimes, you know, we need protecting from ourselves a bit sometimes. My mother was treated for lymphoma, and she was referred to the oncologist, who's a brilliant young chap. And she started off by saying, "Now, listen, young man, I have to start by telling you I think it's a sheer waste of NHS money and your time." He said, "Well, let's just talk about it." And he went through it all with her, and she went and had the treatment. And I think it's sometimes the understanding, and it's looking at data. We've got to understand the data, and we can't. I mean, I was on the Marmot panel for screening, and John Dewar took ages explaining the difference between relative and absolute risk. And I think it's the sort of niceties of the data that we don't understand, and I think it needs explaining and then the decision. But the ultimate decision is what you're being offered, but there should be some choice. And I personally chose the surgeon and then told him I wanted him to take the decision. So I'm sort of not doing what I advocate myself.
Abdelhamid from Chelmsford. It's a question to Dr. Moss. You mentioned the benefit for chemotherapy in this elderly group of patients, mainly with the node negative, so with the HR negative. What about the HR positive with Herceptin positive positivity? Or do they do any different? Thank you.
Yes, so that's a great question, because I think the patients with HER2-positive tumors who are hormone receptor-positive have a different biology. And if you look at some of the data, like breaking them down into the gene microarray categories, they're not all HER2-enriched patients. A lot of these are luminal B2, and they don't probably get the same benefit from the data we have from as aggressive chemotherapy in addition to their endocrine therapy. But that said, they tend to relapse when they do within that five-year period. So I wouldn't tend to be as aggressive in that group with the chemotherapy and Herceptin based on tumor size, and that's why I like your PREDICT model, because I think that that's a great model for these people with smaller hormone receptor-positive tumors. But I believe they're different biology and that they don't all require aggressive chemotherapy and anti-HER2-directed therapy.
Okay.
Alistair, I don't know if you agree with that.
Yes, I would, although the sort of counterpoint is we feel slightly let off the hook because we can give patients, if we have access to it, weekly
yes.
Taxol Herceptin, which, if you like, is a slightly easier regimen to deliver on a day-to-day yeah. basis.
Hyman, your study was superb, and you made the comment about the ER negatives, and you spoke about the CREATE study. My comment, first of all, was that Mark Toy did show at San Antonio that it was ER negative patients,
exactly.
again, who benefited from the chemo. So if there's any group, it is the ER negatives. But I want to ask you a question about ER positives, because you've shown data that shows there's no benefit to them, and there may be subgroups of the HER2 positive, but they're very small in the elderly patients. And most are low and moderate risk patients in that. They're ER positive, HER2 negative, low, moderate risk patients. In your study, only 47 in the SEER data had higher risk. How do you treat, given your data, how do you treat the vast majority of ER-positive, HER2-negative, over 70 patients based on your data? Do you give them chemo or do you not give them chemo?
No, so I actually use the recurrence score. There are other assays on these patients. I think they're very helpful. And I think now with the SEER data and other data, I think that can be very helpful. So these patients, many of whom are going to have, the vast majority are going to have intermediate to low recurrence scores, probably don't benefit by chemotherapy. So they probably never would have been treated by today's standards using some of these better assays. Now, if I didn't have the assay, I'd do a poor man's assay on tumor grade, lymphovascular invasion, maybe Ki-67, although we don't routinely do that in many clinics in the U.S. But I think you have better ways of making this decision. And probably, I would bet many of the people in the study we have today would never have been treated, probably the majority of those patients.
Can I push you slightly further? Given the totality of the ER-positive, HER2-negative population, what percentage of your practice do you think you actually give chemo to in the over 70s? If you're being honest and saying, here's the total number, how many of that population, because it's the biggest population that we treat, and from the data you've got, what percentage would you end up giving chemo to?
I would bet it's probably 10 or 20 and it's dropping. You know, one of the things it'd be interesting is when we talk about omitting things like radiation and chemo, we've got to make sure that people who take endocrine therapy who are going to skip their radiation are compliant with it. Because if they're not compliant with it, then they're going to have a tremendous risk of in-breast recurrence. Plus, all the data on dying of other causes is due to the adjuvant benefit of the endocrine therapy in those patients. And so it's very, very important to, and I don't know how the medicine is practiced here well enough, but we find a tremendous amount of patients who don't fill their prescriptions or never took it, which has made me much more vigilant in these patients about bringing them back early to making sure they're taking their medication.
Okay, there was a question they've been waiting to ask for a while.
Hi, Jane Marr, I'm an oncologist, and I just want to ask the panel, there are lots of really good studies coming up around assessment, and there seem to be some good trials looking at following people up in outcome, but answering your question about why don't you want to give people chemotherapy, it's this vague fear that they're not going to be the person that they were in a year's time. Have the panel got any good questions or good things, simple measures that we can use now while we're waiting for the trials to actually get an idea as to whether our patients really are the same people that they were after they've had the chemotherapy and radiotherapy?
I don't think we do. I think we focused a great deal on our measures on predicting cancer outcomes, you know, recurrence, death from other causes and so on, and perhaps risk from immediate, shall we say, physician-determined toxicity such as febrile neutropenia, because we get worried about shortening patients' lives with treatment. But I don't think we've got many good measures that predict whether a patient will be back to baseline at 6, 12 months, which is an awful lot of the time what they want to know from us. Because taking on from Julie's comment earlier, when you talk to women with metastatic disease, what do they want to achieve? Actually, it's maintenance of independence. And we've done this in studies. It's maintenance of independence is what patients want to achieve. And I suspect that is the true, as you're alluding to, in the radical treatment setting of adjuvant chemotherapy. So I think you're absolutely right.
Anybody else on the panel like to comment on that?
Julie, I'll contribute. I mean, as you know, Jane, there's a big effort going on to collect chemotherapy information in the SAC database. We could well consider using that, and we've got thousands of women who have had adjuvant chemotherapy and hundreds and hundreds who have adjuvant chemotherapy over the age of 70. I can't remember off the top of the numbers, but we've got huge numbers. So linking that to some of the other data sets, PROMS, the HES data, might be a way forward. I don't think we're there at the moment because data quality is a huge concern, but that might be a way of addressing this that doesn't always invoke the need for another randomised trial to do that.
Anyone else on the panel like to comment? No? Okay, so I think actually we're at time, and I think we've had a really interesting session. I'd like to thank all the speakers. They will be around if you've got further questions. Thank you.